talk at some point. And again, she'll be speaking tonight at Portland State University at 6:30 p.m. Be there for extended period, so you'll get a chance to ask questions, make comments, interact with her, and meet other people, and get some movement going. Let's bring back the spirit of the 60s, or...
Spirit of Crazy Horse.
Spirit of Crazy Horse. Okay, going out with John Trudell. Thank you so much, Roxanne.
Thank you.
Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. Three Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war. The poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war, thinking of always war, thinking of always war.
The myth of an exceptional U.S. American people destined to bring order out of chaos, to stimulate economic growth, and to replace savagery with civilization, not just in North America but throughout the world, proved to have enormous staying power.
KABU is co-sponsoring three talks by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, a longtime indigenous rights activist, scholar, renowned feminist, and author of the new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Wednesday, February 18th, she will be speaking at PSU's Native American Student and Community Center from 6 to 9 p.m. She will also be speaking at PCC Cascade and Reed College. For more details, check our events calendar on kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the page.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and it is about 1 minute after 9 o'clock. Next up is Political Perspectives. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, topics include immigration, Black women's lives matter, the toxic oil train derailment and firestorm in West Virginia, and resistance to unnecessary school testing. And at 11 on the food show, what it's like to visit a banana ripening facility, a report from the recent Organicology Conference, a look at a certified organic food distributing company and a Pacific Northwest organic food distributor, and an activist talks about working for food justice. Thanks, KABU members, for your support in our winter membership drive. If you missed it, you can still go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become a member. Today on Political Perspectives, we present a panel discussion on racial profiling and incarceration, which took place on January 25th in Portland following the screening of the film The Throwaways. The panel includes Glenn Waco, Marcus Cooper, and Isaiah Sprigson from Don't Shoot Portland, and Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland NAACP chapter. The moderator is Sequoia Wright, host of KABU's Ear to the Streets of Portland radio program. Bawin Suchak, co-director of the film The Throwaways, also participated in the forum.
My name is Isaiah Spriggs, and I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. I've been here for about a year and a half, becoming involved where I can. And recently I've hooked up with Don't Shoot PDX, and they're doing a lot of good work. And so I'm here, I guess, on behalf of myself and on behalf of Portland, on behalf of Detroit, on behalf of black men, you know, on behalf of somebody who cares. So.
Good evening, I'm Joanne Hardesty, and I'm a member of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. I'm on the steering committee. I am also the newly elected president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP.
My name is Marcus Cooper,
And I'm just a young African-American male that lives this fight, and I'm here to state my voice. I was born in Seattle. I lived here in Portland. I moved around a lot. My dad was in the Navy, so I've lived on the East Coast, the South, out here. So seeing all those different experiences have weighed a lot on my mind, and being a part of this movement, I'm proud to be a part of the Don't Shoot PDX movement. It's given a huge platform for people like myself and other people as well to speak out on what's happening. And I encourage everybody here, once you leave here, don't be afraid to continue your fight and continue your voice. It doesn't have to end right here in this movie theater. The protest is an everyday thing for us.
Hello, everybody. My name is Glenn Waco. I'm a local hip-hop artist and Don't Shoot PDX community member. And just like everyone here, I came here to educate myself, and I want to be the change I see in the world. So protesting is more than just marching in the street. I think this is a form of protest because we can take the information we just took from this movie and apply it to our lives and affect change in the world through that action. So thank you.
So you guys, my name is Bowen, you guys know that. I just want to, first of all, just say it's an honor to be up here with you guys, and I've been following you guys on Twitter, so like I know the stuff you guys are doing, and I'm keeping up with it, and I'm really inspired by what you guys are doing here, because it's really about young people right now, and uplifting and amplifying your voices, so I'm really excited that you guys are here. Just a little bit, I just want to say that one of the things that I'm really passionate about is besides, you know, working on this film for the past years, as I'm an educator, I work at a place called The Free School, which is an independent school that helps kids to kind of find themselves without needing unnecessary standardized testing and a lot of drugs and things like that. And I also run a program called Youth FX, where I help young people to learn how to use media and make films. So check out those programs if you get a chance to see what's going on, because I think one of the things that I'm really excited about is having conversations about models of things that are going on in this country, all across this country, probably here in Portland, models for things that are completely out of the system and are successful, because we do not need to rely on the system to provide the needs of our community.
And my first question is going to go to Ms. Joanne Hardesty. You're from the East Coast. Is there any difference between when you grew up in that area and where it is now?
The biggest significant difference is I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. So black people were at every level, everywhere. I didn't grow up feeling like I was a minority. And when I moved to Oregon and people talked about minorities, I kept looking behind me. Who are they talking about? What do they mean? And so I grew up in a community where I was a community chow. So the whole community was responsible for me. At the time, I didn't like it because, you know, Ms. Jones would be calling my mom to say, Joanne's up here and she's supposed to be somewhere else. But what I realized was the community had a responsibility for each chow. Didn't matter who birthed you, the whole community was responsible for you. And so we don't live in that era now, where the whole community is responsible for the community's children. And I hope that we are at the beginning of recreating a community responsibility for all its children.
My name is Helen Sherman, and I have a story. I don't have a question. I would say people are not just profile per se as one person in the family. The whole family is profiled. You cannot raise a family and get success with people planning and plotting for your whole family. And guaranteed you better not own a home, because they're coming to get that too. So we need to do away with forfeiture. And we need to do away with accountability on people that are not accountable. I do not understand why we are so bogged down, because when I came here from Louisiana to Portland, Oregon, I only live in two places. I came here to be free. And can you imagine how pissed I am? I was 27 when I came, no, 28 when I came here, and now I'm 74. Now, this has been a long fight. It has been a fight all the way. I had 3 children, and all 3 of them are profiled. I became a homeowner, a single parent homeowner. Just me. Well, you can't do that anymore. That's behind us. We need to bring that back. Any 2 people are working low income should be able to buy a house. You don't want to move your family around all the time. It's dangerous. So now back to the police. We need to do everything that possible. We need to be looking out for each other's children. But let's not forget, the police are misusing our children too. They making snitches out of our children, out of our daughters, our fathers. We got 3 generations of people in prison. 3. Never had a job and never had the possibility of getting a job. Thank you.
Please,
please. I'm sorry. Just want to say that I can relate to the profiling of entire families, because I can relate that to gangs. Like, a lot of families like have gang members in them, and the entire family is like branded as that. And like, kids, there's a stigma placed on the kid, expecting, like, they expect them to become a gang member. And I think that within the Black community here, the number one issue is complacency. Like you mentioned, you own the house. We can name a couple more Black people that like own, that know the power of ownership or own a house, you know? So I think the lack of education is an issue and complacency is an issue. I think we need to really address that and combat that.
The other thing I wanted to say, when Helen talked about profiling the whole family, it's more egregious than what Helen articulated. And so let me give you an example. Multnomah County Gang Assessment Report came out last year. Let me tell you what the police within Multnomah County consider a gang member. They consider a gang member 2 or more people who self-identify, right? So they say that there are 147 gangs operating in the city of Portland. Amen, whoever said that. I have said the same thing. So here's the reality. The reality is that we continue to try to get the police to articulate what a gang member looks like. And so they try hard, because they used to be how you wore your hat. If your hat was cocked this way, you were this kind of gang. If your hat was cocked that way, you were another kind of gang, right? But now, because we've challenged them, because their assumption, and let's be real, their assumption is gang members are Black men between the age of 12 and 24 years old, right? And well, I'll get to Latino in a minute, because I think the Latino numbers are underreported significantly, right? Because right now, if you're African American, you're 4 times as likely to be stopped and searched by Portland police. If you're Latino, you're 1.7 times more likely to be stopped and searched. But I believe if you looked deep into the white numbers, you would find a lot of Latinos within those white numbers. And so let me tell you what they find once they stop and search people. If you're Black or Latino, you're less likely to have guns, drugs, and other paraphernalia. Who has it? It's the white folks who don't get stopped. Right? That's the reality of the data. And don't take my word. Go to Portland Police Bureau's website and read their stop data. And you can read it for yourself. Thank you.
So please give your name and ask your question.
My name is Andre Middleton. Isaiah mentioned a little while ago. Say hey, peace out. In regards to the notion of rebirth and getting the community together, I think that one thing that Portland is lacking is a venue, is a opportunity, is a place where people of different voices, allies, can come together and at least start having these conversations in a way that can get some momentum going. I give props to Teresa and Don't Shoot, and looking at the root causes for a lot of these issues, root causes of poverty, education, and so on. So if I get the panel to talk about what might such a vision of place be? What might a place look like that can draw these allies and different communities together in a sustainable way?
Thank you, brother.
Now, from my perspective, it seems as if, like, well, it has to almost be an individual effort in order for a collective effort to be actualized, right? So in order for something or an arena for these types of conversations of growth, it kind of has to happen everywhere, you know? And it can't, I mean, of course, we have to think of churches, community centers, schools, you know, these different obvious arenas, but they have to happen in the homes. They have to happen at family barbecues, you know? They have to happen at all these different situational places that we can reach people who will actually pay attention to us so that they can start to spread the same mindset of growth and recognizing the ignorance within ourselves so that we can grow. And I think that has to happen in the home first, and then it can happen amongst the relationships of those that the home, you know, it's a ripple effect. And I think that for starters, that's what I've
been. Kind of just piggybacking off of that, I think one of the biggest things I hear too is a lot of us, we talk about this, we're all in this fight together, we're all fighting this, we're all fighting that. But then instead of us focusing on that fight, you kind of have this whose dick is bigger contest where my fight is bigger than yours, and no, da 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 da, and no, blah blah blah. And so you have groups out there like Pigs Don't Shoot or whatever group are out there, but it's funny how we have all these groups and we still haven't unified yet.
Thank you.
A house to me, I was raised in the church, and what I was told was the church is not the building, the church was the people. So the house that we're looking for is not a building, the house is all of us. We just all are too busy building our own houses somewhere. I'll just say that.
Man. That way, right to what I was gonna talk about. He said there was no arena. I would slightly disagree with that because I've been to like a lot of different like meetings with friends and stuff, like on and offline, but the biggest arena is Facebook. Like a lot of these conversations that we're having right now, what we see on TV, like I feel like I'm having the same conversation over and over with friends. It's just that everyone's at their own table. Everyone needs to come to the same table and find out a solution together because we're all saying similar to the same thing. So we just need to put our own little agendas off to the side and focus on coming together, like what Ira was talking about.
So next that has a question is Lori.
Well, I don't have a question, but I have a couple titles that I have. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm an ex-con. Went to prison in 1991. I got out in 93. 2004, I won a national award for Woman of Triumph, and that was because I overcame and I helped other women in transition. I also have a clothes closet where I give free clothes to the homeless. I work for Highland Christian Center, and so HIAC stands for Highland African American Youth Community Coalition. It's the first coalition that was put together to do prevention for our African American youth with underage drinking, because we all know it starts from drinking. A lot of the stuff when our kids are in the street and they're getting killed and they're rolling and police is rolling up on them. I also was racially profiled because I have a Tahoe on 22s. And so we need to talk about cars too. They look at cars and they pull them over. And I ended up going to jail. And when I took them to trial, the police officer remembered my tires, he remembered my custom plates, and he remembered my car. So I'm telling you, a gang member told me, he said, your car is like your face. And police officers looking at us, he said, oh, she had a classy car. I'm like, so that's why you pulled me over? Okay, let me give you the last title. I'm going to blow you away with this one. I am the mother of Jasmine Antoine Moore that was shot on the 11th of this month in front of our after hours that we have here. And my son is in ICU right now fighting for his life. So I want to tell you I'm dressed like this because I'm fighting. I'm fighting for my community. I'm fighting for my child. And I'm fighting for me. And I'm ready. I'm in the ring. And they ain't going to get a TK on me. I'm going to fight. And those kids that's out there on this alcohol, this coalition, we're going to do it. So I need you guys to come on the 26th. I got flyers. Come into the house. I've been talking about this. Nobody wants to come. It starts with prevention, you guys. We got to get it. And when you say church. This isn't a church, but we meet in a fellowship hall. And it's about the community coming to the table and us looking at our community saying, what is in our community that's causing our kids to use alcohol? That's causing our kids to be worse racially profiled? And we're going to go out there, and whatever we come up with, we're going back out there and take it back. And another thing, you parents need to go get your children. You said, go around, we can throw money at it, we can do all these things, but I'm going to tell you this one thing. Until you make yourself right with your child and you go out there, you know they're out there doing this, go get them. Go get your child.
Thank you, Lori. And I was asked for everyone to hold your applause until we're done with the panelists, until everyone is done with their questions. If we could just hold the applause for just a second. Well, more than a second, because we're going to have a good conversation up in here.
So, Sequoia, can
yes.
I respond?
And yes, can the panelists respond to Lori?
So what I want to say is the sister that talked about the car you drive. So I want to tell a quick story about Keep Notice. Keep Notice on May 12, 2010, was a 24-year-old African-American male driving his mother's car down by Lloyd Center on 6th and Halsey. The Portland Gay Enforcement Unit looked over at him and said, I quote, he looks like he might be a gang member. Why did they decide to pull him over? Because they thought the car he was driving was too nice for him to be driving as a 24-year-old African-American male. Within 1 minute of the stop, he was tased 3 times by 3 different officers simultaneously and shot 24 times. Now, the police narrative of the story is that after they pulled him over and while they were tasing him, he reached into the glove compartment, opened it up, pulled out a Crown Royal bag, opened that bag, pulled out a gun, shot Officer Burley in the leg, and then sat on that gun. And so the story we continue to hear is of this Superman type black men, right? So when black men are stopped by the cops, they're not stopped by tasers, they're not stopped by beanbag guns, right? So when you try to do that to a black man because he's got superpowers, you know, he just gets more and more angry. So then you have to shoot him 24 times. Now, as a community, no one in the community believes the police narrative of what happened to Keep Notice. And there are many community members that are still seeking justice for Keaton Otis. His dad was killed by Portland police, not by a bullet, but because his dad fought for justice for his son until his heart gave out. And so I will say, as that sister said, the repercussions for families when the police shoot and kill someone is felt for generations.
My name is Cameron. Thank you all for being here today. And I want to thank each and every one of you. I've had a chance to see you on Facebook, read about you in the papers, hear you on the radio, and most importantly, be with you in the streets, be present. And my question is about your story. My question is wanting to understand what drives you guys, what is sustaining you, because we know the path. The road to justice is long, it's curvy, there's potholes, but we continue to do it. Joy, you've been doing it for decades. You've been doing it longer than I've been alive. Many of you all have been doing it for months on end, nonstop, without rest. And so I am just curious about what are the experiences that you all have that continues to have you and people like us in the room continue to do this day to day. What is that community that is helping to drive your passion?
So I'll start and then I'll give the gentlemen a chance to get their thoughts together. For me, it's because I talk to young people all the time. I do a lot of training in high schools and in college campuses throughout the region. And that's what inspires me to keep going, because every social movement in this country has been led by young people. Every single one. And if we're going to have a movement now, it's going to be because young people have stepped up to make it happen. As Cameron said, I'm old. And so I'm looking for the young people that I interact with, they get injustice and they're ready to stand up and take their leadership. And I'm so thrilled that that's taking place.
I love people. Now, and a few people here know me, and love is my drive, love is my passion. And I would say the reason that I'm here, the reason that I'm here as a person, as an individual on this earth, the reason I am here with Don't Shoot PDX is because I want to learn how to love people more practically. I feel as if we always have these ideas of love, we have these ideas of empathy, and yet we're not applying these ideas that we have, quote unquote, instilled into our minds and our bodies and our spirits.
I love you.
I love you, like so much, like I'm for real. And y'all think I'm playing. You know I ain't playing. I'm 23 years old, and I've dedicated my life to basically the betterment of whoever is in front of my face or behind my back or on my left or my right. And that's just the reality of the situation. And so why am I here with this organization? Because justice is love and empathy actualized. And I think that that's something that we always, or me myself especially, I need to continuously recognize. And in order for us to keep going, because this fight is never going to end. It's been going, and this is something I'm recognizing. Like, I'm so new to the game. Not only because I'm young, but because I'm really new to the game. Like, straight up. And guess what? The game has been played. The game's going to keep playing. And unless we take these remote controls, which are our bodies and our voices and our gifts that we've been given, unless we take these and apply them practically and passionately, then things will not change. But guess what? Things are going to change. Yeah.
Anybody else on the panel want to say something before we give the next person?
I could give you my whole backstory on why I do this and all that jazz, but if you did not just hear what she just said, if you did not just see what happened in the movie, that's more than enough. I'm 25, my guy. I could die as soon as we leave here. And are you going to go outside and march for me, or are you going to sing Kumbaya?
Hello.
So, I do this because this is a sense of family, but in my family, everybody's a leader. I'm not going to depend on these people to fight for me. I'm going to depend on myself to fight, and I'm going to stand up for everybody that's fighting with me. We're a pack of wolves right here. Everybody here is a chief right here, and we're all pushing for the same goal. There's a lot of people that have that mouth, but there's no action behind it. I literally went my first march ever that I attended. I literally saw some people. I'm not going to name names or whatever the case may be, but I saw people up there singing. Even if I had the most angelic voice, I don't see what that was doing for the thousands on 2,000 to 3,000 people that they had following in a square block, police-led, singing about the death that police just killed somebody, but were police-led. So I stood up and I said, I don't agree, and I'm marching this way. And then 3,000 people followed me. I believe, and it's kind of go back to what I said, this is not the focus. It's not, I'm not trying to knock your question, nothing like that, my man. What I'm saying is, I'm not on this panel. I did not come out here to take a part of my day. I could be doing whatever. I could be at home playing 2K. Instead, I came here to encourage, just like I need y'all to encourage me, a young black male, to fight for the rest of society, because this is my everyday protest. And this is something I could die for right after this, my man. You could be the next one. That's a real thing. And unfortunately, here in Portland, we're not in Ferguson, whatever. But I believe, whether you're this color or not, we are all in the same fight, fighting the color of blue. And that blue is trying to attack all of us.
We talk a lot about hope and faith, and I always say this. Faith without action is like a gun without a trigger. It doesn't work. So I'm tired of looking in my friends' eyes. I have friends and gangs that are friends and family that are in gangs, and I'm tired of looking in their eyes and seeing hopelessness. Like, they don't believe. I'm tired of everyone pointing the finger at them instead of the conditions that breed their mentality in the first place. And, like, what led to this? everyone wants to point to gang violence and this and that as a problem, but it's like the environment. Like, look at the environment they grow up in. Look at their broken homes. Look at the everyone blaming them for what's going on. So it's like, I had a conversation with my brother, and I told him straight up. It was like, yo, like, do you have any friends that are in the opposite gang? I'm not going to name the gang or anything. He was like, actually, yeah. Like, my best friend is, and it's the rival gang. And I told him, like, you know, it's on you because you're the youngest. It's like, you have to break that cycle. Keep that friendship. You know what I'm saying? It's very important that they see that we're all the same. We're all human beings equally. And that's what Black Lives Matter is about. It's not that nobody else's lives matter. It's that we're equal as human beings. And they want to respect that.
This is a recording of a panel discussion on racial profiling and incarceration, which took place on January 25th in Portland, following the screening of the film The Throwaways. The panel included Glenn Waco, Marcus Cooper, and Isaiah Sprigson from Don't Shoot Portland, and Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland NAACP. Sequoia Wright, host of KBOO's Ear to the Streets of Portland radio program, was the moderator. Bawin Suchak, co-director of the film The Throwaways, also participated in the forum.
A lot of the people that are like family to me now, I met back in the early 90s when we all came together because there was a killing of a young man in New York City named Amadou Diallo. Yeah. And some of you might know that name, but what happened is Amadou Diallo got shot 41 times because he went to reach for his wallet when the cops cornered him in front of his own building, going into his own apartment. And what happened is New York City tried to move the case up to Albany to get away from the media attention, and all of a sudden, a bunch of us were just like, this is enough is enough. And we formed a group called Basta Ya, and we started a whole network of organizing, and people who had never been involved in fighting for social justice got involved. And to me, it's just crazy that, you know, here we are 20 years later, and you guys are coming together and becoming radicalized and together understanding, building consciousness together over the same issue. You know what I'm saying? And I think one of the things for me that sustains me is having people around me that are thinking about the same things and wanting to do something, take action. So I think that's part of what, you know, it means when we're talking about like building that community. It's like we have to sustain each other. It's so important. And like the love piece is so important because this work will drain you. Yes. It is emotionally draining. You know what I mean? Because like the sister said over here, this is life or death. You know what I mean? And for you to share that and get that off of your chest, I mean, I can hear it in your voice. You know what I mean? This is not easy. You know what I mean? It's not easy to watch this film for some people who have experienced this and gone through it, and people that know people that have gone through it. And if you have brown skin, you know somebody that's gone through these exact things. And I think one of the things that I just feel so inspired by here is the fact that young people in this country are raised, to be honest, just to be told what to do, be quiet, respect the authority, and then even when they choose to speak out, and this sister over here that was on, Tressa, that was on the radio the other day with me, you were so inspiring to me because you said something that just been spinning in my head, and you're talking about how when you go to like a lot of white progressive type schools, kids are encouraged to think outside the box, think critically, speak your mind, you know, all this stuff. You go to a black city, inner city school, black school, try speaking your mind.
Thinking outside the box. We've been trying to do that for 400 years.
You know what I'm saying? So
that's all I'm going to say about that.
And that's called, you know, the school to prison pipeline. You know what I mean? So I think it's just so important to identify these things and to go at it and not mince words about it. You know, so as a teacher, for me, it's really hard sometimes to work in the spaces that I work, but what I'm trying to do is really build consciousness with kids. I mean, I have 17-year-old black kids in my class, in my after-school program, that never knew stop and frisk was a term. Okay? 15-year-old kids that had never heard of the Black Panthers. Okay, that is a massive failure in our school system to not teach young black children about their heritage of struggle and power and liberation. Okay, that is, I mean, you know what I'm saying? There is no other people that have fought and sustained themselves than people of African descent. Yep. Everywhere around the world. So,
So we have a next question. Your name and then your question or comment.
My name is Derek Grant. As a teacher, I have a very short sort of thought experiment question for the white folks in the audience, who happen to be most of the people here. Cops make me nervous. When I get a cop behind me, I get nervous. Because I've been pulled over in my 20 years of driving. I've been pulled over half a dozen times. You know, I've gotten speeding tickets. I've gotten, like, forgot to, like, renew my tags and all that stuff. Cops make me nervous. I'm nervous about getting a ticket for, like, 1 or 2 days' pay. Raise your hand, white people, if cops make you a little bit nervous for that reason. Seriously, seriously. Just a little bit, just a little bit, just because that happened a little bit. Okay. Now think about how nervous would you be if you were afraid of getting tased and beaten and shot by those cops. But I get nervous with cops behind me because I'm afraid I put my registration sticker on the wrong side of my plate and I might get a warning. That makes me nervous. Imagine what it's like driving around the city where the cops might tase you and then shoot you. And that is almost every city in this country. And you think you don't have privilege as white people?
This is Tom, and I'd like to connect with a couple of things. I was born in the city of Detroit. I have a brother that lives in Woodward Avenue in a hotel room there. Lived there his entire adult life. He's 82 years old right now. And you know what the city's like. We make a lot of trips back there and to enjoy him. But it's really interesting for all the life he has lived. And I'll just talk about he has been in streets, you know, homeless at times, mostly living in risk rooms. But he has never had a real problem with the police, probably because of his whiteness. And it's really an interesting thing. But from a family standpoint, I'll kind of get to my question. There's the issue of a family throwaway, right? He might not be very valued because he isn't productive. He doesn't offer, even though ecologically, he's probably the soundest person in this in our family. Maybe the most fit because he can walk up to like 15, 20 miles a day. And he goes around Detroit, just like we've seen in the films, picks up garbage, replaces manhole covers, does that for his daily routine. But thank you for the connection and being here from Detroit. Now my question is, which I might be engaged in this stuff all the time, but you go to events around the city, you know, little parties, social things, and you want to try to make a conversation about these things, I find it challenging. And I would like some advice, encouragement to go forward in all kinds of environments to bring up these conversations.
So I think the first thing is thank you. It is absolutely critical that white people have these conversations in the white groups that they interact with. You will make mistakes. Making mistakes is okay. What you need to embrace is that in this country, we have never, ever had an open, honest conversation about race. We pretend we have. We used to say that we were this tossed salad, right? Somehow people come to America and all of a sudden we just toss us all together and we become one. Then we were the melting pot, right? Where we all just kind of blended into one white-like flavor, I guess. But the reality is, as a country, we try to pretend that once we elected Obama, we were post-racial, right? And so we have never, ever had an open, honest conversation about race. And white people can't have that conversation with people of color until they have it with themselves. And so it's important that white people create the opportunities to have those conversations at those cocktail parties, at those faith-based gatherings, at those neighborhood meetings, at those family parties, so that you are having the conversation with the people closest to you. Then and only then are you ready to join a coalition with people of color to actually change what's going on in this society.
Thank you.
to tag on the back of that, I feel like it is very important because, especially for myself, you know, I'm ignorant to a lot of things, especially about the situations and experiences of other people, you know, and I think it's very important for any of us to have any conversation with anyone regarding race or mass incarceration, school, all the things that there is conflict about. I think that it's very important for us to feel out who we're speaking to and understand where they are coming from. Because if we do not, because that's where empathy has, you're talking about empathy and love. To have empathy is to understand that even the person you're trying to educate has had experiences which have led them to believe what it is that they believe. And in order for us to really understand how they think and understand their perspective, in order to even cause a slight shift, which one conversation ain't gonna really do nothing, really, it's gonna have to be a continual battle. We have to sow seeds. And I think that unless we really dig into that dirt and lay some fertilizer down, we're not gonna be able to sow a seed.
Yeah, this is really good. I'm glad you went there. Because here's one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about, and this is sort of what it will tie in, you know, people of Latino descent. One of the things we have to acknowledge about America is that it's such a unique place. It is such a externalization of white supremacy, and it's so covert, but not covert if you're a person of color. But for white people, it's so covert because what we're dealing with is the mentality of settlers, okay? And what settlers do is they build fortresses around themselves to protect themselves because they know that they're on land that was stolen. Okay? So when you know you're on stolen land, you got cameras everywhere, we got to stop and frisk, we got to throw in jail. Oh, they got guns? We got to go kill those people because they got guns. Because only people that get to have the guns are the settlers. When we talk about immigration today, we're talking about people that this is their land. You know what I'm saying? This is their land. And when you brought people from Africa to be here, to be the free labor, to build up the riches and the power and the privilege that you have now that's unearned, those people, all of a sudden, those are rebels. These are rebels. They're in rebellion against the settlers that brought them here against their will. So until white folks get to that real deep level of understanding what they have perpetuated, and again, and I want to say, I love that you're bringing in this empathy and love stuff, because I come from this place of love as well, okay? And I really, really do, because I'm just trying to be real, you know what I mean? Because I think that's part of the problem, is like we like to dance around. You know, we had a screening where someone kept talking about, well, it's not just about black people, it's about, you know, poor people, and it's about military people, and it's about mentally, you know, folks who are mentally, you know, challenged, and it's about all the, and I said, you're right, but we're talking about black people tonight, right? And I remember, you know, but the problem is, like, you know, you have to acknowledge that and own that. And that's really, really, really hard, because what that means is it's giving up power. Yes. And we're really just talking about power right now. So.
I would also, don't be discouraged, you know. I'm going to take this question and apply to us people of color as well. There's a lot of us that are ignorant to all this as well. There's a lot of us that have our eyes closed as well. You don't know how many times I've had to confront my own people about their laziness, about how they're waiting for the next Martin Luther King, but they don't want to be the Martin Luther King. Or how they want you to be the MLK, but we don't want you in the streets. Or I'm too busy, I got this and that. Like you said, being uncomfortable, there's a huge difference between the word uncomfortable and radical. It's not radical for me to stand up in here and tell everybody what's happening in the streets. That's just making you guys uncomfortable. Huge difference in that. It's very important that when you discuss this conversation, what's happening outside, you educate yourself. You educate yourself to the fact that when you address not only white people, but also people of color, because you were addressing people of color that have no idea that this is happening, it's very important that what you're saying is factual and that it's true. You don't want to plant the wrong seed and say the wrong things and get somebody radical, and then they go out there and make a fool out of themselves. A lot of people that come out to the PDX Don't Shoot, when other people are marching next to me, whether you're black, white, or whatever the color, I listen to what you say. If you're not speaking the same thing we're speaking, or you're not about what we're doing, I kick you off. Now, this is not my movement, but you're representing my life. And I'm not dying because of your ignorance. I'll beat you up first. So, education is a real big thing for me. Education is a real big thing. Talk about how black people, we weren't just slaves, how we were kings and queens. Talk about our inventions, our lifestyles, our culture. America loves the culture, but they don't love the people. It's very important that our people get uplifted because we have all this tragedy, all these things that bad happen to us. Yeah, every race has that except for one. But the point is there's so many good things about our culture, about our colors. The number one thing that I really hate, and I say hate, I don't really hate much. I love a lot of good. Love. You know? Empathy. What I cannot stand is the idea of we are all just one people. We should put behind that you're black and you're white and you're Asian and you're brown. We should just be one. Hell no, nah, bro. I am proud to be black. I'm proud of my blackness. I'm proud that you are brown. I'm proud that he's lighter than me and I'm darker than him. And I'm proud of that stuff. Self-awareness and self-identity is one big thing that Portland does not have. And so when you talk about these discussions to people, bring that up first. Say, are you proud of who you are? When you're white, do you understand your white privilege? Do you know how you can use that in this? Are you proud to be black? Why are you afraid of your color? Why are you afraid of this? Why are you afraid to talk about your hair and your style and your music and the way you walk and talk and breathe? That is the stuff that needs to be talked up first before we get into it. But did you know you were slaves and blah, 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 blah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lucia Z, and I'm really happy to be here this evening. I am a Quaker minister, and I've been preaching for reparations back east. I did a tour of all the major cities, and I ended up in Ferguson, Missouri. And it was a very, very intense experience to see the place where Michael Brown lay. And to be a combined voice with 300-400 other people yelling out that we need to indict killer cops. So for me, it's really important that we as white Americans really look at not only recognizing that we have white privilege, but that we give it up and that we use it in a way that's going to promote justice. But I think just like we had to work for abolition back in the day, we need to abolish our privilege by investing in those that we owe. And we have a debt. And it is a human interest. And our souls are suffering because of it. And I had the great pleasure of studying with James Cone with Black Liberation Theology at Union Theological Seminary. And he wrote a book that's called Become Black with God. And also The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And I think when we start looking at God as black, that's when we can start this dialogue that makes sense, because that's when we know that we have insulted God by our comfort. And when I heard somebody say here that we have to get uncomfortable, we have to get very uncomfortable. Slavery was built on the white comfort, and we still have a disparity of wealth today. That one day at a time, I can feel our Creator weep. And if we're not weeping, friends, then we are not truly alive. So I think right now, if we don't give it up as white, if we don't start to pay, and it's not five acres and a goat. I think that we just truly need to give up the land. We need to give up the power. How many whites? My dad had a fourth grade education. When he passed away, he had four homes. Because he worked so hard? No, because he was white. Everybody's working hard just to feed their kids. So I think at some point we need to understand that unless we lead, the leaders will not follow.
Amen, sister.
I think that one of the things that we, as the younger generation, and also with the folks of the less young generation, still as beautiful generation, we need to recognize ways to navigate like the educational system to implement love practically when it comes to self-love, because I think that that's something that we're not taught. a lot of times by our parents because they weren't taught by their parents. And so there's this lack, and we have this continual oppression going on, but we don't have this continual uplifting. And I feel like we don't have these continual ideas of self-love. And so when we don't love ourselves, then we're not going to take care of ourselves. We're not going to take care of the people in our communities. And so I think that, and I mean, I'm no scientist, but I know there's books on science that talk about, or books on science, right? I know there are books that give factual evidence to say that if you have confidence in yourself and you love yourself and you take care of yourself, then you're going to do better in society. And these studies are proven. And yet in the school systems, we're still not taught this. I think there has to be some sort of movement to incite love into the school system, like real practical, not like some, you know, not to get down on hippies, because I love y'all hippies. I'm kind of halfway hippie myself. But we have to practically love our kids. We have to practically love ourselves. We have to practically and passionately love each other. And that's just the truth.
I think the only thing I would add to that is my generation failed you. We failed this generation. And I want to acknowledge that because my generation thought we won. Right? We thought the civil rights movement, we won, we got laws changed. So therefore, we didn't have to be vigilant in making sure that those rights didn't disappear. And so what we've learned from our mistake is that if you're not watching your rights, they're going to disappear.
My last closing comment, I think that an important thing is to teach everyone about the prison industrial complex with the ex-funds. It's like, it was a study that said from 1991 to 2000, the prison population grew 50%, and 75% of that was nonviolent and drug use. So the decriminalization of drugs and stuff, I think that goes a long way. And I think, again, it all comes down to educating ourselves of the past, because it's around Martin Luther King's time. You mentioned the Black Panthers. Not none of the youth really know about the Black Panthers. Well, a lot of our leaders back in the day, like a part of Joanne's generation, like they were killed or put in exile, Assata Shakur. You know, they flooded the hood with heroin, and that led into the crack era. So we've been dealing with post-traumatic stress from that for decades, you know. So education, that's what I would say. Thank you.
I just want to say I'm blessed and honored to be on a panel with you guys. And I'm thankful that you guys are sitting here, hearing my thoughts and my voice. I know for me, education is a big thing. I'm learning every day as this goes on. What I tell my friends, my family, I don't want to be that dead Black guy that you learned about in school that did this back in 2014. And then that's why you march. I want to be that person that's still alive. And that movement that I'm doing, that movement that I'm part of, is the reason why you're a part of it too. In schools, you're only taught about MLK, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, and that's it. And it's only in February. And then you only get 30 minutes to speak in front of your assembly. That needs to change. I'm out here. I've made it a point in my own life to go to every high school. I'm at every high school, make sure there's a Black student union. If there's not one, I've started three so far. I'm alive in three. I'm making sure, I mean, I'm young. I look much younger than I am, but I'm still young, you know. But when it comes down to it, it's like you said, it's very important, you know. My brothers and sisters, educating my parents, telling my parents what's happening. Educating my grandparents, educating everybody that's around me, my dance community, the people that I work with daily. I've gone to these schools, and there's a lot of the people in these schools that they don't know what happened to Mike Brown and Trayvon Martin, except for what was on Facebook or what was on the news, and that's it. And so going into their schools and telling them, like, yeah, you know, you can believe what you want to believe, but when you leave this class, when you walk out, how does it feel knowing that everybody still looks at you a certain way because of this? How do you feel knowing that this stuff is happening in your school, your principals and your teachers telling you not to tell your parents? There's things that are happening, and it's all a system. It's all one big system. We can sit up here and talk about that all night, but one big thing that I just stress to everybody here is the education value. Educate yourself so that you can educate somebody else. Plant that seed to keep going. It doesn't matter what color you are or your age group. Tell somebody, the word on the street is this, and the word on the street is that Black Lives Matter. Spread that message.
Well, we can't really enact change unless we learn, you know, education, educating my, I am in the greatest and most patient phase of educating myself that I've ever been in my life, and that comes along with recognizing my ignorance, and I challenge you all to dissect yourselves and recognize where you have been ignorant in order to combat that, because without that very crucial step, then we cannot move forward from where we are right now. And again, I move back to the love and empathy. Y'all go here. If I'm talking, y'all give me a mic. I'm for real now. And I'm gonna say that, like, all right. So I'm 23 years old. I moved to Portland a year and a half ago from Detroit. Back home, I barely was even involved in the community. I was more involved in like the hip hop and things like that. When I came here, it was after I manifested change, realized my environment wasn't what I needed anymore. Moved out here, and I'm learning that it is the youth. You know, I'm young, but it is the youth. I'm working with the mentoring and tutoring program. I'm also working with the Donald D. Long Juvenile Detention Home, and I feel like what is really necessary is for us to educate ourselves on the judicial system, obviously of the current county and place you're in, because that's something I'm recognizing, but also just letting them know like where the system is, where they fit into that system, and how they can be as preventative as possible from allowing themselves to be injected into that system. And that comes with a sense of empathy, because we have to recognize that even if we haven't faced the same struggles that these youth have or they will, we need to recognize that that is a very, 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 very real struggle. And it's a struggle many have had before, and we've been blessed that others have had worse struggles, and I'm thankful for them, and I have empathy for them, but right now we are in a state of very minimal privilege and very much work to do. And we need to recognize that and do that with love.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I wanted to share something that Angela Davis said a few days ago when she was speaking at PSU. She said the most important thing for this movement right now is patience. And, you know, like, Joanne's been fighting for this for years and years, and so has Teresa, years and years, and so has Angela Davis, years and years. And, like, we have to have patience and accept that the struggle, what we're fighting for right now, might not happen while we're alive in our lifetime. So we have to prepare our kids. We keep saying, like, he's working with kids and we're working with kids. Like, the kids are our future. The youth are our future. So if we care about our future, we need to care about our kids and accept that, you know, the struggle goes on after we die. So, yeah. Thank you.
I just want to say, as a non-Black person of color, I think it is really important for non-Black people of color to recognize that in this moment, like, we also have a responsibility to call out our fellow non-Black people of color, because we know in the Asian community, in the South Asian community, in the Latino community, in the Middle Eastern community, there is rampant anti-Black racism. And I think it's really important to call that stuff out, because that's our role right now, is also to be able to not just be somebody that's like standing by and being part of the movement, but calling out the people that are standing on the sidelines and drag them in. And one of the things I want to say too is that, you know what, like, right now the reality is that we need a revolution, like a real deal revolution. Right? And I say that word, and I don't say it lightly, because it really has to mean revolution, not reform. The system will not change. When people say the system is broken, it is not broken. It is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. Right? So when we say shut it down, we also got to be ready to build it up. Build up what we want, what we want. And part of what you guys, like, I'm sitting here looking at you guys and I'm thinking, so I'm 40, okay, I'm 40. I'm just like, damn, what are you guys going to be like at 40? Damn. Are you going to have like little gray hairs? But I'm like, what are you guys, I mean, you are, to me, so inspiring right now because you're talking about things like self-education and working with young people. So yes, you guys do need to inspire other people. And you know, the one thing too is like we have to recognize also as men that we have to acknowledge the fact that the women that we are around and in our lives are facing an even deeper level of oppression. And we gotta recognize the ways that our masculinity and machoism comes out because it's there. It's really us. You know what I mean? And I'm so, like, I feel so blessed to have women in my life that call me out. And my daughter's 15, and she calls me out because she was taught to do that. And it's a really, you know, it's really amazing. But I just want to say that you guys just have given me so much energy tonight. And I just want to say that to me, when you guys build community with each other and you guys work towards this revolution, you're going to feel so good and it's going to be the most beautiful thing in the world. I just want to thank you guys so much for letting me have this thing.
You have been listening to a panel discussion on racial profiling and incarceration, which took place on January 25th in Portland, following the screening of the film The Throwaways. The panel included Glenn Waco, Marcus Cooper, and Isaiah Sprigson from Don't Shoot Portland, and Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland NAACP. Sequoia Wright, host of KBOO's Ear to the Streets of Portland radio program, was the moderator. Bawin Suchak, co-director of the film The Throwaways, also participated in the forum. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is 10 a.m. Next up, it's Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints. And at 11, The Food Show. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support in our winter membership drive. If you missed it, you can still go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become a member.